Okay, so we're here today with Ellie Hengeveld, and Ellie's in Switzerland, and we're chatting to her today a little about the books that she's published with Kevin Banks, Maitland's Vertebral Manipulation and Peripheral Manipulation, and a lot of the work that she's been done through her career in the field of manual therapy. So I've never met Ellie before. We've just met today. Hello, Ellie.
Hello, Rachel. Nice to meet you.
And you. Thank you for joining us today. I wonder if, first of all, Ellie, you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and just introduce yourself to the people that might be listening to this in this podcast who haven't met you before.
Yes, thank you, Rachel. I'm trained as a physiotherapist in Rotterdam in the Netherlands in 1980. That sounds to me a terribly long time ago, but I noticed that I still love my profession, and I see that there's still every day something new to learn professionally, personally, which helps me in my work as a physiotherapist, but also in my work as a lecturer. In the years that I worked, I worked for a short time in the Netherlands, and then I moved to Switzerland. And in Switzerland, there happened to be a very good postgraduate study center in those years, till the 1990s. And there I encountered the Maitland concept of manipulative physiotherapy. And I must say, I was very much impressed by the logical reasoning and the sensitivity of the communication with clients, the sensitivity of moving and helping people to get to move again. So that became like a thread in my whole working career, the basis of this concept. And then when I did also trainings in other concepts of physiotherapy, can be related to touch, therapeutic touch, but mainly also to movement and movement therapies, the basis of this concept remained with me. Even when I did my Masters of Science in the end of the 1990s at the University of East London, all that work which I did there was very much linked to the basic assumptions and the basic modes of working of this concept. So I'm just very pleased because I think because I learned to assess and reassess, regardless what I did, that probably helped me that I still find lots of joy in my work today.
And so you work clinically now, do you?
Yes, my main part is lecturing, but I also always will treat patients.
Do you any patients in particular or just anyone that walks through the door?
In a sense, anyone that walks through the door, but yeah. I love working with people at their home. I really like that to have the people in their normal context.
Yeah.
But also, over the years, I somehow found an interest also in people with chronic pain.
Okay, yeah. And do you think, this just crossed my mind when you said you treat people at home, do you think it makes a difference treating people at home to in a clinic?
Yeah, because I like to meet people in their normal context. Yeah. And that is always a bit different when they're at home instead of coming to the clinic. It always takes more time. You drink more coffee.
Yeah, yeah, more sociable.
Yeah, but it's very nice. Because I think that we, if you would ask any physiotherapist why they like to become a physiotherapist, I think because you like to work with human beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we could after all those years, I like it much. Yeah.
That's really good. That is good that you're still really enjoying it, still seeing patients even now. And you do, so you said, but your main work is lecturing now. So what do you, I'm assuming that you probably lecture in manual therapy. And whereabouts do you lecture?
Yeah, we years ago, that was under the let's say, auspices or guidance of Jeff Maitland himself, we founded an International Maitland Teachers Association in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And the group of teachers is offering courses, postgraduate courses in the Maitland concept. They're, in total, it's four levels of a course lasting a total of 11 weeks.
Yeah.
And I personally am lecturing in Switzerland, Finland, and in Greece, sometimes in Italy, Germany. Oh, and of course, I'm also lecturing in the Netherlands.
Yes. In your home country. Do you speak all those languages, or do you?
No. Obviously, I speak Dutch, but in Finland, we lecture in English. In Greece, we lecture also in English. But in Italy, I've started to learn Italian.
Oh,
but
wow.
I guess I'm a bit creative with it, but
yeah.
I'm glad we have colleagues who are very fluent in Italian, so they do most of the work nowadays.
Okay. So you're mainly teaching people to become Maitland teachers, is that right?
That is a big part of my job, but as I'm also interested in clinical reasoning, I am sometimes also invited to lecture at universities of applied science, or I'm also involved in a postgraduate course for hand therapists and clinical reasoning. And also I was involved a lot with a course which I set up together with a clinical psychologist on the interdisciplinary management of chronic pain.
Nice.
But it's in a sense all related to my basic work.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. You mentioned clinical reasoning, that you're doing a lot of teaching on the clinical reasoning. Now, clinical reasoning is something to touch upon with the Maitland concept and the Maitland books, because I think, I've done a few years ago now, I did some Maitland training in the UK, and definitely it's one of the courses that I did that changed my practice. And I think it's because, like you've already touched on, it's the clinical reasoning side of things, and it's teaching people to thoroughly assess, thoroughly engage with the patient, and again the reassessment side that you mentioned as well. So all clinical reasoning sort of concepts, and I think a lot of people, I don't know, this is just how I think that a lot of people consider them, for instance, the books and the Maitland concept to all be about manual therapy techniques, whereas it's so much more than that, isn't it? It's all about the approach to patient care and integrating clinical reasoning to become an expert in, to become a clinical expert, or to develop clinical expertise, I suppose. Is that right?
Yes. I think we live a bit with the difficulty of the word manual therapy.
Yeah.
But it was already some 40 years ago when the IFOMT, as a subgroup of the WCPT, was founded, and you had all those people like Freddie Kaltenborn, people around Jeff Maitland were involved, people from America, and the term manual therapy came up as it was distinct of physiotherapy. And I know that Jeff Maitland himself was never happy with it, so he came with a compromised term, which was manipulative physiotherapy, in order to somehow stay related to the profession as physiotherapy. But of course, that the art of manual skills are a very important basis.
Yeah.
And I think there's this misunderstanding that you think, oh, manual therapy, I just learn a few tricks and I know how to do it. And within this concept or this school of thought, I said, no, you need an thorough assessment of the movement disorders of the patients with the symptoms and the signs. And based on that, you work together with the patients on the goals of treatment and the selection of treatment strategies. And passive movement, in that sense, I would say, is a part of the physical examination and a part of the treatment. Like Kevin Banks and me, we said in the book quite often, passive movement is a kickstart or jump start to active moving. It doesn't help a lot only to do some manual techniques without guiding people towards a more optimum level of movement, activity, finding confidence to move, whatever we need in daily life to function. So yes, manual therapy is helpful, but we shouldn't consider it without a thorough assessment of the overall needs of a person and to move. So
yeah. And I think that's where the misconception is that the Maitland concept is that I refer to it. Is that the right way to refer to it?
What did you say?
The Maitland concept.
Yes.
I think the misconception perhaps is that the Maitland concept is all about passive therapy, and it's not really. That's just a part of it. That's a part of the assessment and treatment side of things. But before that comes the full assessment and the clinical reasoning skills that get taught through this concept. I think they're amazing. They're so thorough that you can take that forward right through the practice into the active care that you give at the end.
I think it was quite early already, before even the term clinical reasoning became more modern and widely used. It was already that it was taught by the so-called brick wall principle, that you separate that what you think theoretically or have learned from the theory part, if you try to link it to that what you observe with the patients. And so one basic principle was already, you may get a medical diagnosis, but clinically, we as a physiotherapist should look at the movement and the signs of a movement disorder. And that has changed over the years, because years ago we just said, okay, look for the symptoms and the signs, but nowadays it's well known that the physiotherapy diagnosis is related to terms of movement. So that is related to the principle of this concept as well. And of course, if we do an assessment together with a patient, we also get information or hypothesis about possible biomedical or structural disorders. That is one thing. So we are linked a little bit also still, of course, to the medical thinking. But if we take the example of someone having pain in the area of his elbow, we just have to consider all the possible sources of dysfunctions which may lead to this problem. So it might be something of the elbow, it might be trigger points, it might be referred symptoms out of the neck, out of the thorax, neurodynamic dysfunctions. So that is thinking in hypothesis and trying to make a well-structured examination and treatment process out of this. And that is something which has been linked to this concept since the beginning, that you express yourselves in terms of hypothesis rather than in strict diagnostic terms, based on the idea it would limit your own thinking.
Yeah.
I think that is up to date nowadays as it was some 30 years ago.
And I think that's really important. That approach is really important to remember these days, especially when it's not a protocol and it's not a rule or anything to follow. There are a lot of protocols and rules and things being published, and although they're very useful, it's really important not to forget that we should be open-minded about diagnoses or use hypotheses, like you say. And this is where the clinical reasoning comes in, and this is where you become a clinical expert, isn't it, to
yes.
prove and disprove hypotheses, and also to sort of to allow a hypothesis, I suppose, to progress throughout treatment.
Yeah, that's so nice. You just do not need to know to have all the answers in the first session. I think it's important that in the first session, when you get to know someone,
excuse me,
that you recognize, are there any precautions or even contraindications? That is very important to have the boundaries. But then within, they say, okay, this person may have this elbow disorder. And one therapist may have his focus in the first session on the examination of the local elbow structures. And another one may say, no, my focus is on the examination of the neck and the thorax, for example. They may still be both be right. The only prerequisite would be that you stay open-minded, that you say, okay, I've decided to screen or check for the elbow dysfunction. Let's wait how the patient comes back. And I stay open that I may do some sort of a screening of the other contributing factors and weave, in a sense, that into the basic therapy which you've lined out. To me, that's very relaxing, in a sense. You have your boundaries, and within the boundaries, you're quite free to make your decisions. And, in a sense, I would say you're even forced to stay a bit open-minded, because it's the response of the patient ultimately which will prove if you are moving along the a useful path for him or her, or if you're somehow off track. What I like. And that's the nice thing, as you say, it just is then an evolving process. Mm. And it may well be that the art of passive movement is being used a lot in the first few sessions, but there becomes a natural transition to active movement and building up, helping to build up a better level of function for a person.
Yeah, because the Maitland concept doesn't disregard active movement and exercise therapy, does it? That's all a part of the process.
Yeah. Because, and that's so important, because as soon as we may have figured out with patients, for example, that the neck or the elbow is really needing more movement and passive and active, self-management strategies become very important. And then it's interesting, then you can also stay open-minded to other concepts. You don't have to be exclusive. The work of Robin McKenzie is very helpful for a lot of patients. And if, as long as you put it in assessment and reassessment procedures, you can use almost everything which you have learned along the way as being a physiotherapist, but also what you may have learned on a private interest level. You can introduce those things as long as you prove clinically that they are beneficial for this given person you're treating.
Yeah, and I think that's where the skills of the clinical reasonings, well, firstly, the clinical reasoning skills that you learn through the Maitland concept can be extrapolated into other concepts. But also the other thing about the Maitland concept, it really does teach good handling skills, I think. Yes. I think it really develops how a person feels through their hands and their other sense that we physios seem to have, the ability to feel things through our hands. I think it develops that. And again, that's something else that you could learn through the Maitland concept and take on into other concepts as well.
Yes. Yeah, because I think our instruments of perception are, of course, the observation. When we see a person, we listen, we hear what they say, but we may also get hypotheses on the way how they say things. And the third instrument are our hands, the perception, and that what we express with it. And I think there's no profession, any other profession, which can claim to be the only owner of saying we have thinking and feeling hands. Very much physiotherapy as well. And I think what is nice is that when Maitland started to work years ago on how can we express what we feel with our hands and what the patient tells us at the same moment, so that maybe a sense of motor reactions, or that maybe, and that was called spasm, by the way, before, but it's the motor reactions. Or you may feel a sense of resistance while you are moving into the structures. And a person may say, hey, that's hurting. He tried to put that in a chart, and that became known as the movement diagram, which apparently became quite a topic of debate, because how reliable and how valid is the thing. Mm. But the nice thing is it's a good means of communication. It's still a very good means of communication. You try to express what you felt. Mm. You can discuss it with your with your, let's call it, sparring partner with whom you're learning and practicing. And you can compare. And with that, by focusing on what you feel and what someone says, your hands become more and more refined. I see that happening in a first week of a course already, that the way how techniques are being performed on the very first day, and 5 days later, when you went through a lot of the principles of this work, that the manual handling skills have become much more refined already.
Mm.
So, yes, I think it's the old art of therapeutic touch, which somehow seems to be almost to become forgotten.
Yes, yeah. Well, so that it was just crossing my mind that there's been a lot of debate. Well, there's been some debate recently about the hands-on, hands-off debate.
Yes.
I don't know what you think about that, or whether you have anything to comment on that debate.
Let me keep it short.
Okay.
I think it is all related to perception, uh-huh. I think, because I can see there has been a time or when they started to see why do people develop chronic disabilities and pain. They started with the concept of yellow flags. That was in the 1997. I even remember it was the publication of New Zealand, where they started to list all the yellow flags, and they based that on the studies as they were done. They say, hey, these psychosocial factors seem to hinder full functional recuperation. And one of them was also overly reliance on the skills and the hands of a therapist. So I only need a massage, or only when you move or manipulate me, then I feel fine. And that's, of course, if that is one of the things, that's indeed not very helpful. But I believe that from there you got a bit of a polemic debate, hands on, hands off. People are deconditioned, they don't move enough, so they have to move and get into training. But for what I've seen, if people get a hands off approach and they have to do physical training programs, how can I say that? It may well be that, how can I say that nicely? I have an image in my mind of some patients. They were running on a treadmill, but it was so without any joy, without any confidence, without any energy, that I would even say a bit ironically, the body has been parked on the training machine, but where was the person himself?
Mm.
Was he aware what was going there? There was no therapist around. He was just placed on that machine. And I just think, how can we guide people to become more aware how they use their body, how they move and how they tense up? And there you can say, hey, but with passive movement, you have a lot of communication in the meantime going on, which can be used as a perception training, which they say from, hey, I gave an example. Hey, I was just moving here at your shoulder area, and now you were talking about this story with your boss. Did you notice that something changed in your shoulder? And someone may or may not, but then you may guide someone to see, hey, did you notice how much tension you got? And that the tension in itself may be part of the maintenance of the pain. How did you feel when it relaxed again? So I see touch can help to train or to help people to become more aware of how they use their bodies, how they tense up. And if we do then, if we move along then towards the active parts of training, that we make sure that it is also linked to bodily perception.
Mm.
It's not just only putting people on training machines or giving them some exercises on the mat or with some aids like these elastic bands. I think we go back to the old premise, which I read in a paper of England in the 1930s. How can we teach people to move their body and become aware of how they use it? And there, the art of passive movement, of therapeutic touch and active movement, they are all linked together. We yeah. shouldn't split it up in such a dualistic polemics.
Yeah.
Individualize the treatment and use all the skills we have.
Yeah. So the... my volume's gone funny. So the hands-on approach is a really important part of movement re-education.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is a huge part of physiotherapy and physical therapy. You know, it's all about the movement system.
Because you can also see if someone has been immobilized for quite a while, and you start maybe to work on the mobility, or maybe someone may have a cartilage dysfunction, and you start with gentle passive movements. Theoretically, we may expect that the local metabolism of a joint is being activated.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes a complex rehabilitation process starts with a very simple, small, passive movement. And, well, I would sincerely hope that this balanced approach would remain in our profession.
Yeah.
Other professions, like psychologists, they even say, we envy you guys that you can touch people.
Yeah.
We don't have so much license to touch.
Yeah, and I think
would be happy to sell this out. I just can't believe this.
It's important that we know things like that, that the psychologists have that sort of opinion of our profession as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Very good. Well, thank you for that. I know that's quite a provocative question sometimes. let's just talk about the books then. So the Maitland concept has been, I suppose, gathered together and brought into two really nice books, Vertebral Manipulation and Peripheral Manipulation, obviously one dealing with the spine and pelvis, correct me if I'm wrong, and the other one dealing with the upper and lower quadrant joints. Really nice books. The Vertebral Manipulation has a new edition this year. Is the Peripheral Manipulation a new edition this year as well?
That's right. They're both in a new edition.
Yeah.
And Kevin Banks and me, we decided, as it is, there are so many experts around the world who find their basis in the Maitland concept. We thought it would be nice now to invite them to give their contribution and their viewpoints on the topic for which they were asked. Like Mark Jones from Australia, he wrote a chapter on clinical reasoning. Hélène Maheux from Canada with me, she wrote a chapter on the pelvic girdle. Yuka Kangas, he did beautiful work on the master and his Masters of Science on loading patterns of the foot. Peter Wells, who has been around for a long time, he worked with Kevin Banks on the thoracic spine. We got some people also from England, from the Neuroorthopedic Institute, who wrote about the neck. And so they integrated a lot of pain and pain management there. Toby Hall and Kim Robinson, they did a chapter on the elbow. And so there are some information there also of Brian Mulligan's work on mobilization with movement. So we think we felt even privileged that all those people were happy to contribute to this book, just to see how, or to demonstrate how this concept is still very much alive and having its place in the contemporary field of praxis.
It is nice when so many great clinicians come together to produce a book. And it's quite a change from the previous edition to have the additional authors contribute.
Yeah, because, of course, the vertebral manipulation up till now has been the monographs of Jeff Maitland himself.
Yeah.
The peripheral manipulation has been reorganized already some 10 years ago by Kevin Banks and me.
Mm-hmm.
But We just felt over the time that it just would be so much more helpful for the readers to see how people are working with this concept all over the world. And as Jeff Maitland himself passed away in 2010, we somehow liked to show as well that with the passing of, let's call it, the great master of this field, that didn't mean that the work has passed away. In the contrary, it's more alive than ever, we dare to say.
I forgot what I was going to say about... I know what I was going to say. And although it's called Vertebral Manipulation, I think I probably mentioned earlier, although the books are called Vertebral Manipulation and Peripheral Manipulation, it's not just about manipulation, is it?
No, it is... We brought in a subtitle. Let me quickly look. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I hope you can edit this out.
Yes.
The title is, it is in fact, Management of Neuromusculoskeletal Disorders.
Nice.
Because it was already in Jeff Maitland's time that focusing solely on techniques like passive movement, that gives way too much restrictive image of what it is all about, like you said in the beginning already. It is the overall assessment, your own judgment, the reasoning with it, and then a part of it is the skill of movement, passive movement, as mobilizations, manipulations, soft tissue techniques, that is a part of the whole thing. So the first time that the book was published was in the 1960s. And then Jeff Maitland had a lot of the focus on the techniques, but still within already an aspect of assess and reassess. So the first title was Vertebral Manipulation.
Mm.
And that title remained till the 1990s. And then when Maitland withdrew from writing himself, then the title evolved into Maitland's Vertebral Manipulation, Maitland's Peripheral Manipulation. So the title is more a development over the history of the last almost 50 years since the first publication. I personally would love it to see evolve the title into Management of Neuromusculoskeletal Disorders.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's really all about.
It is, yeah. I think that's the important point to make, I think. It's nice that the title remains. I think a lot of people know the books, but it's really good to know that they aren't just about manipulation and, like you say, developed into the Management of Neuromusculoskeletal Disorders, Volume 1 and Volume 2, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we really did our best also with the other publications already. There where it is originally Maitland's work and Maitland's writing, we took that in and we refer to it as well. So, for example, the chapter on communication and the therapeutic relationship is something on which I worked and I love to do it.
Mm.
But you can see that a lot of the communication examples and a few of the principles were originally published in 1986 by Maitland himself. So I was very happy that I could take this chapter, add in other aspects of a therapeutic relationship, but its basis is still the based on the work of Maitland, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it'll always be that way, the book, definitely always based on the work of Maitland himself. And it's just nice now to have experts or clinicians, practitioners who are well-versed in the Maitland concept contributing to the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it because you can so much learn from everybody. And if that is a basis of exchange, then it's wonderful. Particularly as well, some people may have learned the principles of this concept, let's say 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And then they may think, but as it was then, that's the Maitland work. but it has evolved over all those years. And that was also always the principle. I remember that I met Maitland in the year 2000 in Adelaide and in Perth at a conference then. And he said, well, there where I had to stop because I'm getting old, it's where you guys have to continue and develop it on.
Yeah, nice.
And it was in the time that I explained how I was working with my master's project, where I was investigating how manual therapists in Switzerland were dealing with the psychosocial aspects of our work. Because in the 1990s, we, of course, were dealing with the patients as thinking and feeling human beings, but we didn't discuss those aspects much. That was very implicit reasoning at the time. And now you can see when I explained that to Maitland, he said, yeah, it's probably there where I had to stop that you guys are continuing.
So how do you think the concept has evolved?
I think it has evolved in the understanding that the clinical part of our work is always related to movement diagnosis.
Yeah.
It has integrated the rehabilitation models like the ICF.
Mm-hmm.
It was very easy to incorporate that what was published in the field of clinical reasoning, because it's an expression of many things as we have done that already. Over the years, obviously, the work of neurodynamic examination and treatment, very, very much integrated is pain sciences, so working with the neurophysiological pain mechanisms like nociceptive pain. How would you deal if someone has a strong modulation of the central nervous system, autonomic nervous system mechanisms? So that has been involved. And also, I think we are very much aware what is going on in the world of science. I can see in some of the countries in which I'm teaching that it seems as if evidence-based practice is the new rule.
Mm-hmm.
But evidence-based practice in our thinking has to be linked to clinical reasoning, because we still have to individualize the treatment for the patients.
Mm-hmm.
So we like it a lot, what I think the British say a lot, it's our clinical work is evidence-informed practice.
Yes.
So I think our whole group and all the people around the world, they're very much aware what is going on. Quite a few are contributing to research as well from a clinical perspective. So yeah, it's very much alive, probably even more nowadays than 60 years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I'm a bit anxious to see a bit of a rigidness when practical guidelines are being developed. And they're guidelines, but they're sometimes interpreted in my eyes as a rule of action and thought.
Yeah.
I said, no, don't sell out your own reasoning and your own decision-making.
I think that's a really special skill that we have as physiotherapists and physical therapists, is that ability to clinically reason, and we must never give that up, I think.
No. I saw quite a nice statement in an article of the year 2000 already of Bensing is her name, from the Netherlands. She asked in that article how evidence-based is client-centered therapy, and how client-centered is evidence-based practice. So she tried to make a link. And there's one statement which I do not forget so easily, because she warned then already, if practice guidelines are too rigid based on what we think is evidence at the moment, it may well be that we delegate our own individual decisions, which we make with patients, that they are delegated to the meeting rooms of the associations.
Yeah.
And it can never be done.
No.
So I'm very much open, and I like research. I like also trying to stay as much as up to date. But in the meantime, I'm also a bit anxious in these times. The guideline says this, and don't move outside of it. And you And then we forget just to look from, is this what my client needs, who is sitting opposite of me?
Yeah, I think, using the term evidence-informed practice and also incorporating that with individualizing treatments or management for each individual person is really important. Well, that's been a really nice summary and discussion of the book and the both books and the Maitland concept itself. It's really nice to hear how the concepts evolved from you, who's been involved in it for such a long time. I don't suppose you have any particular message for in relation to your work or the books or whatever for our listeners that you would like to send out to them. Just perhaps for the younger listeners who are, you know, trying to professionally develop and become clinical experts, I don't suppose you have any messages for them.
No, it's a difficult thing.
Yeah.
I think it's good if one starts in their career and developing their experience. You make your experience, and over the year in certain fields, an expertise will develop. But you will help yourself with developing a true expertise if you really build up your treatments on a thorough assessment of what you've heard and what you've seen, and that you keep comparing the results together with the clients you're treating. Keep comparing the results if they are of benefit to them, and if not, having the courage sometimes and a bit of the discipline of adjusting the therapeutic process. And that's, there's no shortcut to expertise, but you can really enhance it by a thorough basic assessment and reassessment.
I think that's lovely. That's a lovely message. And I'm quite sure that some of our listeners will take on board that message. So I think that's a nice place to end, unless you have anything else that you'd like to add today.
No, thank you very much, Rachel.
Yeah, it's been really nice talking to you. Thank you for your time, and thank you very much for your insight.
Well, thank you for the interview. That was a pleasure. Thank you.